Chapter 7, Boston, Massachusetts, 1984 to 1986. I flew to Boston, got a hotel room, and met the district manager, Brad. We sat down to dinner, exchanged pleasantries, and toasted my success. He was eager to explain the style of doing business in Boston, perhaps hoping that I was not sent there to rock the boat. I listened. I told him how much I appreciated what he was saying, but in the end assured him that change was good. It was healthy. It built character. And I hoped he was ready to become a new man. I sensed that he felt threatened and was a bit pissed. I don't know why. All I wanted to do was spend a couple of weeks there so that I could completely change everything he knew and enjoyed about his job and then head back to Kansas City. After 1 week of me instilling Jerry's style of business, Brad quit. Jerry called to tell me that he expected it. He also told me that I should find an apartment and plan on sticking around until the dust settled and a new district manager could be found and trained. I said, "No problem, Jerry, and that's what I'm here for." We lost a couple of employees from each location. That was pretty normal when batons changed hands. My work was cut out for me. I found a nice company-paid place to live and now had an incredibly challenging job. At first, I didn't like living in Boston. The people seemed cold. The city was crowded, dirty, and expensive, and that's just what I told our new field rep from Naritsu. I told him I really miss Kansas City and would not live or work in Boston unless I was paid $30,000 a year. I thought this sum was so ridiculously high that no one in his right mind would give it to me. I may have had a few self-esteem issues. After 6 weeks, Jerry and his partner still had not found a new district manager. Jerry called me to say he was on his way up and invited me to dinner. Before our drinks were served, Jerry told me that I was doing a great job and he wanted me in Boston permanently as district manager. I told him that I wasn't interested in his proposal. He went on to say, "Jim, to be honest with you, I really don't have any current need for you in Kansas City. And did I tell you we would increase your salary to $30,000? You never saw anyone change his attitude faster. I replied. "Now that I think about it, the architecture in this town is breathtaking. The seafood is phenomenal, and there's a great nightlife. In fact, where else could you find the kind of history Boston possesses? And New York City is right around the corner. I accept." My overall experience in Boston was wacky, to say the least. I had to move out of the place I was in because the company wasn't going to pay for it, and I couldn't afford it. I found a much more reasonable place the next week. I left my car in Ohio for my brother John to use because driving and parking in Boston were activities for richer, crazier people. I was getting fairly solid performances out of my four managers. Unfortunately, I became good drinking buddies with three male managers and eventually went to bed with the only female manager. But that's not the wacky part. After 8 months, I began to enjoy Boston. There were a lot of things to see and do. The variety and quality of cuisine choices were excellent. The architecture really was beautiful. The history was fascinating. I had fun with all my managers. I came to love the subway system, especially since Jerry covered the cost of my monthly tea pass. There was a great bar in the Church Street business district called the Blue Sands, near one of my stores. Its mixed drinks were a misnomer. They were usually all alcohol, with a splash of mix. Whenever I went to the Blue Sands, I finished my stay by ordering one more potent drink in a go cup and head out the door to the tea stop. Subway rides were fun, but they were even more enjoyable with a drink in hand. A serious drinker would tell you that's true for most situations. Whenever I was in the Church Street District, I had lunch at Pizza Pizzazz. It was a plain, cavernous restaurant. The middle of the place was filled with long folding tables and chairs. There were no waiters or waitresses. To get a pizza, you got in line along the right side of the wall and filed forward until you arrived at the counter in the back. You gave your order, moved along to pick it up, and paid at the end of the counter. Pizza Pizzazz served two kinds of pizza, cheese and pepperoni. You could buy it by the pie or by the slice. It was your traditional New York-style stone-baked pizza, thin, crispy crust on the bottom, great sauce, and perfect blend of cheese and just enough pepperoni. I do a fair job of making pizzas at home now. Last month, I came close to perfecting the Pizza Pizzazz. Not quite, but close. Practice makes perfect. On weekends, I rented a cargo van to move chemicals and merchandise between the four locations. This rented van allowed me to enjoy the surrounding areas for the remainder of the weekend. For instance, the best and biggest filet mignon I ever enjoyed was at the Hilltop Steakhouse on the way to Saugus. I have fond memories of fried clams and fried clam po' boys while in Cape Cod. Just outside Boston is the no-name restaurant. Delish. And the thickest slice of prime rib delivered by the very rudest waitresses in Boston could be had at Durgan Park in Faneuil Hall. One Saturday, we had so much stuff to move to the Cambridge location, I had to rent a 17-foot U-Haul truck. I picked up everything from the Boylston location and headed toward Cambridge. I knew how to get to Cambridge by this time. Just hop on Storrow Drive and get off, you know, when I got to Cambridge. It was a beautiful sunny afternoon in November. I was moving along at a good clip on the entrance ramp and gently eased into the light traffic. All I could think of was, boy, life is good. About a mile down Storrow, I was approaching an overpass. The closer I got, the lower it looked. However, I figured it was just an optical delusion. My confidence was such that I didn't hesitate to fly under it at 60 miles an hour. So far, so good. As soon as I passed under it, I looked in my side view mirror and noticed some tiny red pieces of something fluttering in the air behind me. I later found out that these were the running lights from the top of the truck, which had been sheared off when I went under the bridge. Whatever it was, my stomach took a little flip. I took a much closer look as I approached the next overpass. I finally noticed the absence of other trucks on the highway. I started to slow down for the next overpass, since this one really looked low. It hit me all at once that this must be a truck-restricted stretch of road. I continued searching the highway for other trucks. There were none. I came to a stop 10 feet before the next overpass. I was certain by then that my truck should not have been there, and equally certain that it would not fit under it. I eased the truck up to the overpass until the roof of the trailer firmly touched the bottom of the bridge. Even at that, I punched a baseball-sized hole in the top of the trailer. I slowly backed off and said to myself, "Tidyman, you idiot! You've done it again!" I sat there for a minute trying to decide what to do. Not that I had many choices. I could back the truck up for 5 miles while trying to stay on the shoulder until I got to the last on-ramp. Or I could let enough air out of the tires to lower the height of the truck and drive through to the next overpass. Or I could sit there and wait for the inevitable intervention of Boston's finest. I tried the first, backing up for 20 feet, and stopped. I rejected the second idea and settled on the last. It didn't take more than 10 minutes for the gendarmes to arrive. As they pulled behind the truck, I got out to greet them. No explanations necessary. They knew I had my head up my butt. I knew I had my head up my butt. All that remained was getting the truck turned around and on to legal thoroughfare. The officer radioed a squad car to block the entrance ramps to Storrow Drive. It took 15 minutes for the last car to pass us. Once that happened, I was instructed to turn my truck around and head back to the starting point. Some of the cars heading in the same direction on the other side of the street no doubt knew exactly what was going on when they saw me, a lone truck, wrong side of the road, but going their way. If you have lived in Boston long enough, you have probably heard on the radio at least once a month, "Good afternoon, Boston. This is Irving, your eye in the sky, reporting that another U-Haul truck is having an adventure in moving, or as I like to put it, another out-of-towner has his head up his butt." I finally pulled up to Photo World in Cambridge, my destination, and got out of the truck thinking, "Oh boy, what a ride, no ticket." 30 seconds later, the officer who had corrected the fiasco pulled up and asked, "You didn't think that was for free, did you?" "Actually, I did. The ticket cost $50. Despite how busy I was, I still found time for love, or something like it. One day I had to pick up something from a drugstore next to one of the one-hour photo stores in the Church Street District. I thought the clerk behind the counter, Ellen, was really cute. I found out later she was Jewish. I'm partial to Jewish women. I was 10 years older than she was. Each time I was in the area, I made excuses for other purchases so that I could stop in to say hi. Before long, 6 purchases later, we started dating. Not long after that, she moved in with me. After I had been in Boston for a year, I got a call from Jerry saying he had sold the four Photo World locations to his partner's brother, Tom. He went on to say that if I chose to, I could stay on as district manager. He also said that this might be a good idea since he didn't have anything for me in Kansas City. Given that choice, staying in Boston seemed like a good idea. No doubt Tom was a nice guy and good businessman, and I probably should have cut him some slack. Unfortunately, when I met him, all I could think of was what a smarmy bastard he seemed like. He looked like Ward Cleaver, but had the personality of Major Frank Burns. I didn't like him, and was even less enthusiastic about the changes he wanted to make. Naturally, I agreed to his face with everything he said. Then I dragged my feet, making the changes. The one thing you could say about my management abilities was that I built solid teams under me. I always wanted to be ready to move up and leave someone qualified to take my place. I soon learned that bosses like that too, so if they wanted to bump you or dump you, a qualified replacement would be waiting in the wings. It took a year, but Tom finally had enough of my bullshit. He fired me. I hope he appreciated my foresight in grooming at least two store managers to take my place in the event I was shoved up the ladder, not out the door. It was one of the few times I had been fired where I begged to either keep my job or stay on in a lesser capacity. I never had a boss who succumbed to this groveling, including this one. And why should he? I didn't have another job or another paycheck lined up. I was concerned.